The field of mental health counseling is growing rapidly, and Richmond Graduate University can equip you with everything you need as a licensed professional counselor while integrating your faith into your clinical practice. Programs are offered in Atlanta, Chattanooga, and online. Apply today at richmont.edu. That's richmont.edu. Support for WABE comes from the Community Foundation for Greater Atlanta. You can go beyond giving to impact. Learn more at cfgreateratlanta.org.
Mostly cloudy skies. Welcome to this Monday edition of Closer Look. I'm Rose Scott. Coming up in just a moment, an Atlanta City Council member is proposing a ban on short-term rentals in single-family neighborhoods.
The City of Atlanta has yet to promulgate any real, you know, protections or policies that will protect the public's health, safety, and welfare in cases where you have beleaguered neighbors living next to chronically unruly short-term rentals.
Now, that conversation with District 7 City Council member Howard Shook is coming up in just a moment. In other news, a Clayton County Sheriff deputy has been fired for excessive use of force. This comes after a video surfaced on social media showing two deputies restraining a black man, 26-year-old Roderick Walker. In the video, one of the deputies, who was white, is seen punching Mr. Walker repeatedly. In a statement from the Sheriff's Department, it cites a criminal investigation is now in Clayton County's District Attorney's office. Lawyers for Walker say he was a passenger when the driver was pulled over for a broken taillight. Walker was reportedly arrested for battery and obstructing officers. He was denied bond, according to the sheriff's office, and that was due to outstanding warrants, including possession of a firearm by a felon and cruelty to children. Walker's attorneys are calling for his immediate release. And this, North Georgia Technical College students, faculty, and staff are mourning the death of the college president, Dr. Mark Ivester. The 57-year-old died Saturday from complications with COVID-19. The college wrote in a Facebook post, quote, "We are all devastated and will miss him terribly." Funeral arrangements are pending. And at this time, there are 6,333 Georgians who have reportedly died to the coronavirus, and the State Department of Public Health reports there are 294,314 confirmed cases here in the state. And there are 25,369 hospitalizations. Of those, 4,827 are ICU admissions. This, of course, is all according to the Georgia Department of Public Health. And speaking of the coronavirus, there's going to be free COVID-19 testing at Ebenezer Baptist Church this coming Saturday from 9 a.m. to 4 p.m., and screenings for asthma, as well as chronic obstructive pulmonary disease, also known as COPD, that's also going to be available. Face masks, children's school supplies, free flu vaccines, and food vouchers will also be available. And those interested are encouraged to pre-register at trustedmessengers.org. Again, that's at trustedmessengers.org. This is Closer Look. Closer Look continues now here on 90.1 WABE, Atlanta's choice for NPR. As always, I'm Rose Scott. An Atlanta City Council member introduced a proposal last week that could change the way short-term rentals operate within the City of Atlanta. Now, your short-term rentals obviously are Airbnb and Vrbo and others. Now, the ordinance would ban short-term rentals in, quote, residential neighborhoods. Now, this comes after some community members voiced concerns that, yes, these can be problematic. Noise, large parties are often disrupting their neighborhoods. How could a ban like this be enforced? And what effect could this have on those who use the short-term rental platform to actually make a living? Joining me now to discuss all of this from District 7, City Councilmember Howard Shook. Councilman, thanks for taking time. I really appreciate it.
Good afternoon.
Let's clarify, because I've already gotten a lot of emails, and folks want some clarity. Would this ban all short-term rentals, even existing rentals?
You know, there's been some confusion as the story has sort of been disseminated. Mm-hmm. I'm distressed to see several media outlets have deemed this a complete citywide ban in all zoning classifications, which it's not. Mm-hmm. It would deem short-term rentals as a prohibited use in Atlanta's single-family zoning classifications.
And Councilmember, for our listeners who may not understand that, well, they say, what's the distinction here when you say a residential neighborhood and what you just defined? Is there a difference here?
I think most people would say yes. A single family neighborhood is, you know, what you would think. It's a single families, detached houses, mm-hmm. as opposed to a multifamily building, which is also residential, and it's also a community in its own way.
Mm-hmm. What about condominiums? Are those mixed-use developments where you have families living there, but it's also might just be attached to some commercial entities?
Yeah, my legislation does not include those uses.
So we're talking about residential neighborhoods. Gotcha.
Single-family neighborhoods.
Gotcha. Now, this is actually would be an amendment to the 1982 Atlanta Zoning Ordinance. So what would this new ordinance change? Would it simply say there can be no short-term rentals in these designated neighborhoods? Is that point blank and period? That's what it is.
Yes. I'm under no illusions that, you know, we're going to end up there after a cursory discussion. There's going to be a lot of voices. Mm-hmm. It's not going to be a quick discussion. I, for one, along with other council members, want to see this disseminated to all of Atlanta's neighborhood planning units so that we can hear from everybody. I'm one of only 15 council members, so there's going to be 14 other opinions yet to emerge in the conversation. And then we're going to see what the administration's appetite is. And obviously, we're going to hear from individual short-term rental hosts and their platform representatives and the industry representatives.
What led you to introduce this legislation, Councilman?
Well, here we are years later, and the city of Atlanta has yet to promulgate any real, protections or policies that will protect the public's health, safety, and welfare. In cases where you have beleaguered neighbors living next to chronically unruly short-term rentals.
Mm-hmm. Unruly? Take that further for our listeners?
Well, not to put too fine a point on it, but, some of these include for-profit parties with cover charges and valet parking and live music until 5 in the morning and, you know, weapons and drugs and alcohol. Those are extreme. A shootout in the case of one of mine in the front yard. And so while I appreciate that the industry is taking some steps to sort of police this in-house, I think it's entirely inappropriate to have a for-profit private sector industry be the city's guarantor of the public's health, safety, and welfare. I think for better or worse, you have to rely on local government to provide that.
So you're saying that there has been, and I imagine we could verify this with the Atlanta Police Department, that there have been shootouts. You mentioned drugs and alcohol. You have proof that there have been either drug usage or you're talking about drug transactions. I want to be clear for our listeners here.
Okay, so a couple of things. I'm repeating what I've heard from neighbors and from what they've seen. And then there's also been cell phone footage that's made the rounds from inside some of these venues.
What did the cell phone footage show?
It shows what appear to be inappropriately loud music and valet parking and cover charges. I mean, you can't use a single family home for a commercial purpose until all hours of the night, and inappropriate behavior involving what appear to be at times guns, alcohol, and drug use.
And Councilmember, in an interview with the AJC, you talked about that you experienced this personally, that this was in, you lived near what you considered a party house that was a short-term rental. Is that not true?
No, that is true. I'm one of many such neighbors.
What went on? It was just partying and being loud? And...
Well, rather than rely on my assessment, you can go on TMZ.
Yeah, I saw that.
Well, that's what was going on there. Yeah. Now, that doesn't look like a normal activity that would be seen in a single family home.
People partying? I mean, people party, Councilmember. You're saying that this...
Oh, well, now, come on now.
Well, I want to be fair about this. Were you talking
about partying? I've never been to a party like that.
Well, that
home's generated 90 calls to APD.
Okay, now we're getting to the core of the problem. It's disrupting the neighborhood in terms of just the loud music and the folks and all of that. Just too many people and loud music and the valet parking. One listening would say, okay, that is legitimate. That is fair. As far as anything else taking place, I can understand listeners saying, if your concerns about some real criminal activity taking place, that might lead more to people being more understanding. You understand that. Is there a compromise here, Councilmember Shook, you think, with the short rental platforms here? Maybe hold them accountable. Maybe the city could fine them, because then that way, perhaps, they will be a little bit more strict with the criteria, or if folks keep getting complaints and they shut down that short-term rental. Is there a compromise here? Do you need an ordinance, though, to enforce that?
Well, I think at the very least, what needs to come out of this after a long discussion with all the stakeholders is the city needs a mechanism where it can effectively enforce bad operators. Mm-hmm. I totally appreciate and recognize steps that some of the platforms have taken. Enlightened self-interest is a wonderful thing. It makes the world go around. And what they're not all that quick to tell you is that there have been complete bans in many, many cities. Mm-hmm. Because lawmakers wade into this innocently thinking, well, we can just put some compromise together. And at the end of the discussion, throw up their hands and say, no, banned, entirely banned.
That party house in your neighborhood, are you all able to talk to the owners at all of that property?
They've had discussions with the city solicitor and the Atlanta Police Department. Hmm.
Did they have
a
response?
They own and operate two or three strip clubs. They're, they know their way around the system.
Well, one would argue that may not be fair what they do on the other side as it relates, though, to their party, to this, quote, party house. Did they have a response? Did they say, okay, we're going to work on it, or they had no response? What do you know?
I'm not aware of any response other than allegedly they've put the house up for sale.
Oh. Hmm. In a state.
The last advertised party of theirs was prevented before it started by the city. There's warrants out, multiple warrants out for their arrest, multiple citations that have been racked up. And, the courts are kind of limping along because of the virus. So, that's dragging this out.
Hmm. In a statement, Councilmember Shook from Airbnb, it reads in part, quote, "The vast majority of Atlanta hosts are sharing their homes responsibly, and a blanket ban would hurt thousands of local families who depend on the income they earn hosting to help pay the bills," close quote. What is your reaction to that?
Well, that's a great question. And here's what I would say. If you own and operate one of these homes and you're a rule follower and a good neighbor, I'm going to say, well, first of all, thank you for being a good neighbor. People who generally live in a single family neighborhood have a certain set of expectations about the kind of life they want to lead. And so thank you. I would say that in addition to the more publicized problems, I think maybe I'm more aware as an elected official of others, of the feeling more and more neighbors are having who live next to such a house. And even when they have never been prompted to call 911, mm-hmm. I think there's an increasing sort of fatigue that comes from never knowing who is supposed to be next door, who is not supposed to be next door. who's coming and going at all hours of the day or night. I think knowing your neighbors is one of those expectations people have when they live in a single family neighborhood. Now, I would also say, you know, and I know, even though you've been a good, responsible owner, this conversation's been a long time getting here, and it's here, and we're going to have it. Mm-hmm. I'm not out to put anyone out of business, but I wanted to start this discussion, start it in a way that got everyone's attention, and I want this to be a discussion with a beginning, a middle, and an end. And we'll see where it goes. I've been around a while.
Mm-hmm. And Airbnb also noted, we should note in their statements that they are committed to working with the city of Atlanta. So you're open to having conversations with these short-term rental companies, home-sharing companies, or is the solution for you just to ban them in these single-family residential neighborhoods?
Well, you know, I have 14 colleagues, and so 8 will decide what's going to happen, obviously with the mayor playing a big role in that outcome. And so I'm not sure where it's going to go, but my conversation is really with the city of Atlanta. They're the ones who have got to develop a system to backstop and support these beleaguered neighbors. And so to the short-term rental platforms, mm-hmm. and as a collective industry, my very heartfelt, earnest advice to you is you need to be negotiating with the administration. Mm-hmm. I've been around too long to get whipsawed in between the administration, individual owners, individual platforms, and the industry. My negotiation, to the extent it's a negotiation, really is going to be with the city and my colleagues.
Well, do you have any suggestions to the city and your colleagues on what could be a compromise for both sides?
You know, I'm totally willing to take a look at what some other cities have done, and that's develop a license, permit, registration process with the expectation that a license can be granted and there will be conditions under which a license can be revoked. And I appreciate that some of the platforms are taking steps to do away with bad operators. I have a couple of concerns about that. I mean, some of the better, more responsible ones, they do not have a market over the entire industry. And as we can see with bad alcohol licensees, it's pretty easy, it appears to me, to come back under a different identity. Just plug in somebody else's name and you're back in business.
Atlanta City Council President Felicia Moore told the AJC she's not sure about the ban. In fact, she's saying she's not sure it would gain traction on the council, and I'm quoting her here, "I think he's throwing a wide net and it will be a discussion starter," close quote.
I believe she's an astute observer.
Okay. Councilmember Shook, if this ordinance does not gain traction, if it doesn't go anywhere, what other avenues will you explore?
I'm an optimist. I believe we're going to end up in a better place than we are now. Where we are now is nothing. The city does nothing to curb these places. So I think everything's going to be up for grabs. What's the definition of a short-term rental? How many days a year? Does the owner have to be on premises or not? If the city does devise a policy, well, who's going to run it?
Yeah, how do you enforce it?
Hopefully not the people who are supposed to pick up our yard trimmings.
How would you propose to enforce this? And who's to say that someone just won't file a complaint because they just don't want an Airbnb or a Vrbo, whatever, in their neighborhood, just because we have an ordinance down to support that? How do you enforce this? How do you make sure that people are being fair about this?
Well, for the city to be in the license award and presumably revocation business, then it's going to have to meet, you know, all applicable state standards that come with that.
that house in your neighborhood? Is it still operating to your knowledge, Councilman?
I believe things have been quiet the last couple of days.
All right. Well, where is this proposal right now?
It's been introduced. It's been routed to the zoning committee. The zoning committee, since the virus-related city hall shutdown, and I'm on the committee, we do our committee work in committee of the whole in conjunction with our twice monthly council meetings. So it won't be taken up until then. My recommendation is going to be that we hold it so that it can be sent out to all of the NPUs so that we can garner their comments. And I'm looking forward to that. And I wish City Hall was open, because that way I'd be in closer contact with my colleagues and I would have a much surer sense of kind of their appetites about this.
What's the feedback been so far? I imagine you've heard from supporters and opponents.
From council?
Oh, just in general? From the
public. Well, so I had a couple of council members call me before I introduced it and say, hey, you mind having some company as a sponsor? I said, sure. I had some council members call me up and say, listen, I'm a little nervous about this. I assume this is your attempt to start a conversation and that you have an appetite for compromise. I said, well, we're going to see where that goes. The industry is gearing up. I mean, they're organized. They're doing what I would do. I'm hearing from a lot of people who say, well, you know, for God's sake, don't shut me down. I do everything the right way. Interestingly, they all say, well, we hate party houses too, but, well, that's kind of two halves of the same whole here. So I think everyone seems to be in agreement that there needs to be better protections against the bad ones. I mean, it hurts their industry, obviously.
Mm-hmm. District 7 City Councilmember Howard Shook, thank you so much for taking the time. I really appreciate it. We will stay on top of this. Keep us posted as well.
All right. Thank you very much.
Support for WABE comes from the Community Foundation for Greater Atlanta. If you love Atlanta, you can invest in the big picture. Learn more at cfgreateratlanta.org.
I'm Earlonne Woods.
I'm Nigel Poor. We're the hosts and creators of Ear Hustle from PRX's Radiotopia.
Ear Hustle is a show about life inside prison, but it's not your typical prison podcast.
In this next season, we've got stories about the objects people keep inside their prison cells.
About residents in a women's prison who say they want to stay there.
And the most beautiful prison garden. Earlonne, I will never forget it.
Ear Hustle. Stories about life on the inside, told by those who live it.
Find Ear Hustle wherever you get your podcasts.
Closer Look continues now here on 90.1 WABE, Atlanta's choice for NPR. I'm Rose Scott. It's a question on the minds of many. How close are researchers to developing, testing, and then the federal approval of a COVID-19 vaccine? President Donald Trump has repeatedly stated a new vaccine could be available before the election. However, Senator and Democratic vice presidential candidate Kamala Harris has said, quote, she would not trust his word on getting the vaccine. Normally, it takes years to develop a vaccine and then receive approval from the U.S. Food and Drug Administration. And this was part of the conversation I recently had with Dr. Stephen Hahn. He's the commissioner of the FDA. You know, in June, while speaking with ABC News, you stated, and I'm going to quote you here, I can't predict when a vaccine will be available. And then just days ago, in a video briefing with the American Medical Association, you said, let me assure you that we will not cut corners. All of our decisions will continue to be based on good science and the same careful, deliberative processes we have always used when reviewing medical products. Commissioner Hahn, what assurances are you willing to give consumers, any folks here in Georgia who are listening to this program, that you will stick to that? Because everyone wants a vaccine. Everyone wants something to be done now. And as I stated earlier, coming to the segment, usually a vaccine takes years and years, and people want it now.
Yeah, Rose, let's break that down, because that's a really, really important question. And thank you for asking that. So you're right. It normally takes years to develop a vaccine. So the quickest vaccine that I believe was the vaccine that was developed for Ebola, and it did take several years from identification of the virus to approval. We call it licensure, but approval by the FDA. And the reason that that takes place is because, and you described it really well early on, you start with identification of the virus, then it goes to the laboratory. Different types, there's several different types of vaccines. You can use several different approaches. A manufacturer might use one approach versus another because that's where they have expertise. It gets tested before it goes to the clinic. If it looks like it gives an immune response in animals, for example, then it can go to phase one. Phase one is a safety trial where we are looking at the safety of that vaccine in human beings. So it's called first in man. You need FDA approval to do that. Then you stop, you take a look at the information that you have, and you go to phase two, which is an efficacy effectiveness trial. Then you stop, you look at the data, and you go to phase three, which is typically a randomized trial versus a placebo, so an inactive vaccine. And that's where you really get the most definitive data about safety and effectiveness. And this all happens over a several-year period of time. Now, what's happened here because of the urgency of the situation, and I want to emphasize something you said. I have said this repeatedly. Of course, everybody in the world wants a vaccine as soon as possible, and everyone in the world wants a vaccine that's 100% effective. Now, I know from being a doctor, there's nothing in medicine that's 100%, but we are going to push for as an effective vaccine as possible. So, but in the current situation and the urgency, what happened was multiple manufacturers came forward trying multiple different approaches. And my analogy, Rose, is multiple shots on goal. Now, that doesn't typically happen. All tested very early on against the virus in models and then going to these trials. What we did at FDA with the manufacturers is to provide technical assistance to them and say, hey, you know, let's compress the timetable for these studies. So we'll review on a rolling basis the data that you generate and move what we call seamlessly from phase one to phase two to phase three. Now that cuts off months, if not years, from the approach. The other thing that's been done is that folks are manufacturing vaccine at risk, meaning that if you're a manufacturer, you're going to wait until you get FDA approval before you even think about manufacturing the vaccine. You're not going to spend a nickel on it until you know that it's been authorized or approved. But thanks to the foresight of Congress and this administration, there were funds put aside to allow for manufacturing at risk, meaning all this time manufacturing has taken place. And we've provided technical assistance to those manufacturers so that if there's an authorization and when that if that occurs, then they'll be ready to administer the vaccine very quickly. So both of those things have compressed. Now, we haven't skipped a phase of the trials, and we haven't skipped assessing the data. What has happened is a very significant compression of that timetable. Now, when those data come to us, Rose, I want to say again what I said in that other interview and assure your viewers and the American people, FDA will not cut corners. We have thousands of scientists, many of the world's best experts on vaccines. We have reviewed and authorized vaccines over the years. We will continue to use our criteria. It's why we were explicit about what we wanted to see in vaccine trials. Back in June, we issued that guidance, said, hey, you want to come to us? These are the data we need to see because we're not going to cut corners. And so I'm very confident of the fact that although it's been an aggressive timetable, that we will have data that we can look at, and then we'll make that decision. It might be yes, Rose. It might be no. And we have to all understand that from an expectations point of view, but we will use our high and rigorous standards.
Commissioner, you of all people know the importance of clinical trials, typically in these phases, but there's always a need for multi-ethnic participants. And that is so important regarding COVID-19, given what we're told about the disparity in cases in terms of racial groups and those in high-risk groups. Is that something that you all can, you can't mandate? I don't know if you can, but is that something you all are also stressing to these manufacturers about, you know, if you're going to do these clinical trials and make sure you have a cross-cultural pool of that can participate in the clinical trials?
Rose, critically important, critically important. In our guidance at the end of June, this was explicitly stated. You must have diversity of populations because think about it. Our vaccine trials need to reflect America, because what we want to do at the end of the day, when we see those data, if the data show safety and effectiveness, we want to be able to say those results are generalizable to the public. So it means underrepresented minorities. It means the elderly. It means those with significant comorbidities. It means the people who have been disproportionately affected by the virus. Now, we have had the opportunity to visit some of these vaccine sites, and I'll have to tell you, everyone is talking about how important this is. So, for example, I was at one in Miami, and they have very much paid attention to this. So I think this is top of mind for everyone. Mm-hmm. And our initial information from those who had registered online for the trials, and there's two ongoing right now, and a third going to start very soon in phase three, the final stages. But those who have registered, there has been a significant proportion of underrepresented minorities, elderly, et cetera, mm-hmm. In these trials have registered. So I'm confident that they're hearing the message, but those are the data we're going to want to see, because it's absolutely necessary that this generalizability occur.
And Commissioner, as we start to wrap up, and speaking of messaging, and obviously everyone's talking about, listen, you must wear a mask. We have to slow the spread of this virus. Through your lens, from your viewpoint, take off your commissioner hat, but as a physician, do you think as these kids are going back to school that masks should be mandated in the schools? Or do you want to leave that up to districts?
So I will take my commissioner. I'm a father too, Rose. Mm-hmm. This is a really important issue. We know that parents want to have a choice here, not necessarily about masks, but about school. We have provided significant guidance about this to the American public and to the schools. And this virus is still with us. So I strongly, and I mean strongly, encourage all Americans, schools, workplaces, et cetera, to follow the very common sense approach that we have recommended and that other public health officials have recommended. Wear a mask when you can't socially distance. Socially distant, protect the vulnerable, frequent hand washing. Those are the tools that are going to keep us moving forward. They're the tools that are going to get us moving to the next phase of this and get us to the point where a vaccine might be available. These are the tools that are going to allow people to go to work, support their families, et cetera. So it's critical that this personal responsibility be there. And that's regardless of whether it's school, work, stores, et cetera. And mm-hmm. so I definitely want to emphasize that. I do, however, Rose, believe that these decisions must be local, because folks know their communities better than we do in the federal government. But I do want to strongly urge that these public health measures be instituted.
And finally, Commissioner, look, you lead one of the most important departments, agencies, whatever, in the nation. People's lives can depend on the guidance and regulations that you all set forth. So if there is messaging that is frankly unproven or untrue, whether it comes from social media or especially if it comes from the White House, does that not present a problem for you? Because then you have to respond to questions from folks like me to counter messaging that's coming out of the administration that put you in this position. How do you grapple with that?
So regardless of source, if there is information that isn't correct, you are absolutely right. The agency takes that very seriously. And I want to give you an example of this. Hundreds, and I mean hundreds, of fraudulent products are on the market, mm-hmm. Stating that they diagnose, cure, prevent COVID-19. And they're just not true. And we have spent a lot of time trying to educate the public. And so questions like this from you are very helpful, because FDA authorization during this COVID-19 process, the pandemic, is what is our stamp of approval. And we take this very seriously. So we are going to spend a lot of time talking to the American people about what is the truth about the medical products we regulate. And then one final just comment to this is that, you know, hand sanitizers, we have discovered that there are a set of hand sanitizers that have a type of alcohol in it that could be toxic to human beings. We've been very explicit about this. Mm-hmm. We put it on our website. It contains an alcohol called methanol, and we've called for a recall of those products, and that's ongoing. And so just another public health message to folks, please visit our website. It's been in the news for the last month or so, but another example of how we just have to be careful, and we need the right information to be out there for people.
Well, and people expect that from the FDA when it comes to products. But again, if there's messaging that is flat out wrong from the administration, is it not a responsibility of you and your physician in this to combat that and say the president is wrong or this congressperson is wrong or whomever is wrong? Is that not a responsibility that you have to the American public to say that?
It is always a responsibility of me personally and the FDA to state the facts and to counter when the facts are not out there. We take that very seriously, Rose, and I will continue to do that.
Dr. Stephen Hahn, 24th Commissioner of the FDA, member of the White House Coronavirus Task Force. Commissioner, thank you so much for taking the time. We've been talking about efforts that your department has been doing to combat this virus. Thank you again for taking the time. I really appreciate it.
Rose, thank you, and would love to come back and talk some more. These are really important issues.
We'd love to have you back, Commissioner. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Rose. Take care.
Closer Look continues now here on 90.1 WABE. This is Atlanta's Choice for NPR. I'm Rose Scott. According to data collected by the Atlanta Continuum of Care, last year approximately 3,200 unsheltered or homeless people were living within the city limits of Atlanta. Now, the Atlanta Continuum of Care is a collective of more than 100 organizations that work together to address homelessness within Metro Atlanta. You know, we've talked a lot about this on this program. The pandemic has exacerbated the challenges many of the area's unsheltered populations face. And that led to many seeking refuge on MARTA and at rail stations. And now two organizations, MARTA and Hope Atlanta, are coming together with a new initiative. And joining me now with more is Lyle Harris. He's the Senior Director of Customer and Employee Experience at MARTA, and Jeff Smythe, the Executive Director for Hope Atlanta. Lyle, Jeff, thanks for taking the time. I really appreciate it.
Thanks for having us on the show, Rose.
Lyle, I'll start with you. I know the transit system did experience a lot of folks seeking refuge on MARTA, at the rail stations, and during this pandemic, you all saw a lot of that.
Yes, we've had over the years a challenge with homeless individuals who are seeking shelter on the transit system. And that's not unusual. It happens at major transit systems all over the country, in fact, all over the world. But we, as being part of the Metro Atlanta quality of life, we realized that there was time for MARTA to take a strategic approach to this issue. And instead of just enforcing rules against, you know, sleeping at our stations or loitering.
Jeff, the member organizations that make up Hope Atlanta, I imagine you have heard from them about the increase in need for services during this pandemic.
Absolutely. I mean, our experience, of course, was firsthand at the airport. We've had outreach teams there overnight and during the day for several years. And then we were doing a lot of increased outreach, particularly around Doraville Station, downtown, all over, really, all over the lines. And so it really made a lot of sense for us to be able to partner together. We were doing so much outside of the stations, made more sense to do work inside the stations together as well.
And I want to ask both of you to address this. Did you also notice that this increase in folks seeking refuge were not who would be labeled as chronic homeless individuals, but also folks who might have just needed a place to stay because of the pandemic, they weren't working, or this was where they would sleep and then go to work during the day?
Absolutely. You know, I think we have in our mind when we think about individuals experiencing homelessness about someone who's chronic, who is challenged with mental health issues, substance abuse issues, perhaps. But many of those that we've served, that we've already been able to serve through the process, have been those that are just find themselves in a really tough place. And I really think that in, I think it could happen to any of us. And so, it, you know, whether it be just, you know, pandemic related, You know, we helped an individual who was actually a chef at a restaurant that had closed. So I think there's a lot of different stories of individuals who go to MARTA because that's familiar. They know they can seek shelter there. To your point, Rose, they can still maintain work if they've got it, or seek work if they don't. But it really makes sense to have outreach teams, you know, partnering with MARTA day in, day out.
Lau?
We don't have any exact numbers around, you know, what the reasons are for folks who are seeking shelter on the system. But anecdotally, certainly our employees as well as our customers had been telling us that they've seen an uptick ever since coronavirus started. Yes, certainly from what we've been hearing from our employees and our customers, those are the facts on the ground, that there are just more people who are needing shelter, and MARTA just is a convenient place to find that shelter.
Jeff, with your member organizations, was there a time period where they couldn't accept folks because of the pandemic, because of the concerns about the communal spread of the virus?
In terms of our partners, shelters, et cetera, even food pantries, yes. You know, we do so much street case management where we're trying to get individuals placed, whether that be in a shelter, whether that be in short-term or long-term housing. But yes, the shelters were experiencing challenges in terms of just some of them were closing, some of them had limited hours, some of them, for good reason, were limiting the number of individuals that could mm-hmm. stay each night just so that they could have safe distancing. And same with pantries, right? Lots of different pantries and food places to get food and soup kitchen type situations across the metro area that were closed, that were, you know, doing things differently, particularly at the beginning of the pandemic.
Let's talk about this new initiative. How did you all come together?
Our leadership at MARTA had decided a while ago that we needed to do something, and trying to figure out what that something is. Fortunately, we had begun some conversations with the Regional Council on Homelessness, with the Gateway Center Shelter in downtown Atlanta, mm-hmm. and with Hope Atlanta, with whom we'd had some relationships in the past. But I'll let Jeff answer that. He was sort of on the ground at the time.
All right. Jeff?
Yeah, from the Hope Atlanta perspective, because we were experiencing so many people experiencing homelessness at the airport every night, we had gone from about 50, 75 individuals a night to 100 to 200 to 300 over about a month and a half. It was crazy. It was crazy, Rose. So what we started to do is actually not only just do outreach at the airport, because we were doing a lot of COVID screening, a lot of just anything we could to try to help folks into different types of shelter or housing. But we actually started going up into the MARTA rail line up to the Garnett Station just to make sure that we had a team there as well, especially around midnight, 1 a.m., because that's when the traffic was so high. Mm. And really led to more conversations with MARTA leadership. MARTA leadership helped us with some transport as the City of Atlanta and other partners were able to open what we call a healthy hotel for individuals experiencing homelessness during the pandemic. For those who are, you know, those who were coming to the airport and other places who were more at risk for COVID, you know, MARTA helped us with transport, just, you know, particularly with those who were in wheelchair or more fragile, to be able to be transported to the hotel. So it really led, and thanks to the Regional Commission on Homelessness, to more conversations around how can we do this year round? How can we pilot something together? And how can we make sure that this is kind of system-wide, right? I mean, I think some of the challenge with the way that homeless services operate is they're by a continuum of care area. And sometimes that doesn't quite make sense with how, you know, the MARTA rail lines travel and how the city works. So this gives us a chance to really coordinate across DeKalb and Clayton and Fulton and inside the city, outside the city. It's really, really exciting.
This sort of speaks to MARTA's mission about connecting people. Yes, we're basically connecting commuters who are going back and forth to work and home, but we're also connecting the community in the larger sense by, again, becoming the sort of the sinew and the connective tissue for the city in terms of helping organizations who are doing things like Hope Atlanta.
If you're just joining us, I'm joined by Lau Harris, Senior Director of Customer and Employee Experience at MARTA, and Jeff Smythe, Executive Director for Hope Atlanta. We're talking about a new pilot program. These two entities are coming together to help Atlanta's homeless. Well, Jeff, I want to go back again so it's really clear on how you all will help individuals. Will there be caseworkers out there? How exactly will this work?
Yeah, it's really exciting, Rose, because actually, when we've looked around the nation with our roots as Travelers Aid, we've got a lot of connections with transit all over the country, and we're actually not seeing anything this innovative across the nation. So it's exciting to see. We've got two case managers we're hoping to add with amazing stories, amazing lived experience, who their sole purpose is to make connections and to develop trust. And with that trust comes housing solutions, right? Mm-hmm. So some of those housing solutions are quick. Some of those are slow. Some of those take a lot of paperwork and birth certificates and identification. So it takes a minute. Others, we are able to move very quickly. So it's intended to be just like any case management, very individualized, so that person experiencing homelessness can really, you know, kind of identify their goals, their strengths, and also what housing solutions can be best for them. And the idea is to get them into that housing solution as quickly as possible, with permanency, right? Like, mm-hmm. we don't want to just get someone into housing where they're going to be back out on the street in a month. We want to make sure there's permanency to any housing solutions.
But Jeff, you mentioned, and Lyle, you know as well, it goes beyond for a lot of individuals needing a place, a roof over their head, shelter. Lyle, you mentioned there might be situations where there is a need for mental health resources or substance abuse. Are you all able to connect those individuals that need that with the right nonprofit or with the right entity that's also involved?
Yeah, absolutely. That's part of our job, right? To make sure that those connections are happening, those connections are followed up on, right? And in some cases, we're able to do that in-house, right? We work with Department of Behavioral Health in the state. So we've got an outreach team that just does behavioral health work. And so sometimes it's a referral just to that team. Mm-hmm. If it's a veteran, we can refer right in-house to our own veteran team. If it's a person living with HIV or AIDS, we can refer right to a team inside of our own operation. But in other cases, it may be a referral, as you said, substance abuse, other situations like that. We will make sure that the referral happens and then follow up, because, you know, we don't want to just do a referral and then, you know, see someone back, you know, a week later, mm-hmm. still needing help. We want to make sure that we continue to track with them and help them get served.
And how is this going to be funded? It's a pilot program for now.
So yeah, the idea was we just want to test this out and experiment. A few other transit systems have tried similar approaches, and we just thought this was a very promising one. So the way it works is MARTA is funding, subsidizing the cost of the case managers, as well as in addition to the two Hope Atlanta case managers who, again, as Jeff said, are very experienced and very passionate about their work. We have two field protective specialists who are part of the MARTA Police Department who accompany those case managers on their rounds. And they're there to make sure everything goes well and to provide any services that MARTA might be able to offer. So we're looking to expand this program, hopefully, I think, after a year. But we just wanted to spend some time to figure out if it was working, how we can refine it, how we can make it better, and how we can make it more expansive. But we're absolutely looking to build partnerships, not only with Hope Atlanta, but with the other service providers in Metro Atlanta.
Jeff, you mentioned that you all have already been able to help some people. You mentioned one of the stories there of a chef. Can you give our listeners an example of how you all have been able to help someone?
Sure. I mean, I was looking at just our August. So we've been at this a little bit more than a month, and just our August report, 42 different individuals engaged in that time, and solutions range, right? Some, mm-hmm. for some, it's reunifying back with family, in another state. With others, it is simply just helping them get transportation back to where they want to get to. Others, it's shelter and housing. But yeah, we've had some exciting stories of, you know, an individual who really was looking for help, had been short-term homeless, had only been a couple weeks, and our organization was able to help them. The case managers were able to help him, get connected into an emergency hotel. And during that time, it's a month in emergency hotel while we're working with him on permanent housing. And so he's still in the hotel, but doing well, working on the process to get into permanent housing. So that's just one example. We've had a lot of different really exciting stories of just individuals that really had nowhere to go, had nowhere to turn, and really felt like they would be kind of under the radar on MARTA, and had no idea that there was outreach case managers there that could help them with solutions.
Jeff, were there entire households or families that you all have been able to help as well?
I'm not seeing, Lyle, correct me if I'm wrong, I'm not seeing any families yet. We've had some with youth as a part of a group that we connected with, and we're able to make some referrals to youth-focused organizations that we partner with, since we didn't do that in-house. But yeah, I mean, we're there for any individuals, families, youth, older adults, you name it. We want to make sure that we're able to help all.
And is that transition hotel still operating?
Yes, absolutely. There's several that we're working with, but yes, the main one with the City of Atlanta is still operating, still working on housing plans for a good number of the individuals, but that's ramping down as we're able to get individuals into housing.
And Lyle, before you wrap up, I want to give our listeners an update, because this is something that we had covered. There were concerns that folks that were on MARTA that were heading to the airport to seek shelter. Have those numbers been reduced?
Again, I don't have those exact counts, but that's obviously our aim. It's our goal to reduce those numbers. And again, to provide as much in terms of services and help and support as we can.
And finally, as we wrap up, Lyle and Jeff, you all are coming together. Obviously, you may not be able to help everyone. You heard those numbers I mentioned coming into the segment, the 3,200 at the last count of homeless folks within the City of Atlanta. What is your hope for your organizations that you will be able to have a huge impact on those numbers?
So we have no illusions or delusions about our ability to sort of fix this problem, but we just know that we have a role to play. Our goal is to see if we can make a dent in the challenge that people are facing every day. These are our friends, these are our neighbors, these are folks who we share the city with and this region with. So we just know that we have a very integral role to play, and we'll be expanding our outreach as much as possible. We encourage folks, and again, we've gotten a lot of calls even internally and externally from folks who've heard about this program, and they want to do something. This is just the outpouring of compassion and a willingness to help. We ask folks to, if they haven't already, if they're riding the MARTA system, to use the See and Say app. It's a free app that's available for smartphones, and they can send reports directly to the MARTA Police Department, which will then be filtered to Hope Atlanta. But we need everybody. We can't do this alone. We're not doing this alone, but we need everyone in Metro Atlanta who cares to step up and help us out.
And Lyle, before I get to Jeff to give him the last word, the system is not arresting people just for simply, barring any other circumstances. They're not simply arresting folks who are just seeking shelter for riding the rail system or the buses.
Our credo is that homelessness is not a crime. We will enforce the laws and the rules about, you know, certain types of behavior on the system.
Sure.
We're not compromising on that. And ultimately, we want to make sure that it's a ideal transit experience for everyone who's on the system. But homelessness is not a crime, and we're not treating it that way. So that's really how we're approaching this.
And Jeff, I'll give you the last word.
Hey, thank you. We're just very grateful for this opportunity to raise awareness about partnerships like this and about approaches like this, right? I think there's a sense of kind of how do we police our way out of homelessness? And I think what we're finding all around the nation is that's not working, that's not a solution that's certainly making connections, working on housing, and frankly, working on affordable housing up the pipeline is something we're also dedicated to. But for today's focus, really those outreach teams where you have individuals with lived experience who can make connections and work on each case, that really has proven over and over again to be effective. We're grateful for MARTA. We're grateful for others like the airport who have done this for years. We're even hearing rows of a private donor through the Community Foundation that wants to support this effort together. So these kinds of things are really catching hold, not only in our city, but across the nation. Really great for that.
Jeff Smythe, Executive Director for Hope Atlanta. And I was joined by Lyle Harris, Senior Director of Customer and Employee Experience at MARTA. The two are coming together to address homelessness with a focus on direct outreach and regional collaboration with other nonprofits. Thank you all for taking the time. I really appreciate it. Thank you.
Thank you, Rose.
Appreciate you.
That's it for this edition of Closer Look, which is produced by Grace Walker and LaShawn Hudson. Our engineer is Shelley Canavy. If you missed any of today's program, it's online at wabe.org/closerlook. And of course, you can listen to Closer Look weeknights at 8 p.m. and listen whenever you want, because Closer Look is now available as a podcast. Just visit NPR One or your favorite streaming app and subscribe. This is 90.1 WABE, Atlanta's choice for NPR. I'm Rose Scott.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
The Gold Dome Scramble podcast is now Plugged In, a WABE politics podcast. New name, same in-depth, on-the-ground reporting from us, WABE politics reporters Sam Greenglass and Raul Bally. We'll cover local, state, and national politics as we go beyond the headlines with journalists, voters, and politicians. New episodes drop Fridays starting April 26th. Listen and subscribe at WABE.org or your favorite podcast platform.